Quite often after Christmas time, my wife and I go away and stay with friends. Incidentally, my wife and I, together with the members of the team here, we do most warmly wish everybody a very good Christmas. And whether you're away after Christmas or around that time or not, may it be a time of peace, strength and joy and confidence for you. Now, when we do go away, we sometimes stay with some friends in Merseyside. And I remember, I think it must have been a couple of years ago when we were staying with these friends. They had their Christmas tree all set up in the hall. And at one point I was guarding the house while the others went out to do some shopping or something. Then I heard a ring at the door, front door, and I was reading a paper in the sitting room. So I flew out, and in my haste to get to the door in time to answer whoever it was there, I knocked over the Christmas tree. It was a pity. It was a double pity because it was one of those trees that the pine needles don't stick onto very well. So by the time I picked up the tree, there was a great mass of pine needles on the floor, mounds of them, and the little tree had just lost everything. Well, Christmas for that little tree was over. Now, sometimes that comes earlier, sometimes later. When the wrapping has been thrown away of the Christmas presents, when the last curled up dead turkey sandwich has been consumed, you know, there comes a point when you have to say, it is over. We're trying to take the bigger view for these precious minutes together. The bigger view, the lasting view of what Christmas is about. So as you look at Matthew, that's what I'm going to look at, Matthew chapter 2, I want to look at verses 1 to 3 here, and to look at one or two of the characters in the story. We're entitling this little study, When God Came to Earth. Matthew 2, 1 to 3. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Maybe you know how the story goes on, how he inquires about where the Christ child is to be born, and then of the murderous plot to destroy the child, and of how the wise men from the east are given early warning of his murderous intentions, and so they go another way, and how Mary and Joseph have to escape with the baby to Egypt, and how there's many little babies in Bethlehem were slain. It was a truly awful time, a bad Christmas. And yet at the heart of it was something that is, well, wonderful, that has just changed history. In the end, it's Christmas, the real Christmas, centering in what Christians like to call the incarnation, God becoming human. It's Christmas which by its message either makes or breaks a person, a family, a society, or a nation. The real Christmas. Quirinius, the governor of Syria, had no idea that his name was going to be read in countless carol services all over the world, little school services, infants, nativity plays, and the like. Everywhere, simply because he happened to be governing Syria at the time that Jesus Christ was born. The same with Caesar Augustus. Don't suppose, honestly, we really have heard of him, but for the fact of Christ. The same in Bethlehem's Inn. When you think of that little inn scene and the complete obliviousness of those who were in the inn as to what was happening outside in the yard, outside in the stable. The greatest event of all history that separates BC from AD was happening just outside. What are they doing inside? Well, I suppose they were playing darts or something like that. They had no idea. And as for Herod the Great, he's called, who lived from 74 BC to 4 BC. There might have been a mild footnote about him in the archives, especially because of his great building works. Why, only this week another of his palaces was excavated out there in Israel. And his 10 wives, Herod and his swimming pools, we have heard about those things. And there in the footnotes he might have stayed, but for his involvement in the event of Christmas. Here, look at it again. Matthew 2. The wise men come saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him." And Herod, we learn, is troubled. Christmas faced him, and Christmas faces us across the centuries with a debate. It always does that if we're looking at the real Christmas, not just the plastic Christmas. Christmas faces us with a debate. And the debate had already gone on for centuries in the Jewish nation. The expectation had been there for a long, long time. The old prophecy had been made 500 years earlier by the prophet Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 9 verse 9, "Behold," he says to Jerusalem, "thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass." And so the Jewish people of Zechariah's time then were saying, "Well, where is he? Who is he? How can we recognize when this king comes riding into Jerusalem on a donkey? Hope we can recognize him when the time comes." Or Isaiah chapter 9 that we were having read earlier this evening in our service. And verse 6, "For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and a government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of his government and of peace there will be no end." It's talking about another kingdom, a lasting kingdom that will never be rubbed out. Or Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, another of those prophecies centuries back, "But thou, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be a ruler in Israel." So the debate would have gone on. Who is this ruler? How will we recognize him when he comes? He's going to come from Bethlehem, we learn. And of course, those wise men and other people knew something about this. Just something. Simeon, the old man, who we read about in Luke chapter 2, who'd been waiting for the arrival of this Messiah king, this leader of a new kingdom. When he finally saw him, he recognized something inside said, "The moment has come." Then he came out with those words that we often sing in churches today. And then in a moment or two, he said in Luke chapter 2 verse 34, he spoke to Mary, the mother, and said, "Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising of many." He's going to split humanity right down the middle. Some will be for him, some will be against him. And their eternal destinies will rest upon what did they do with this child? How did they react to him when he came and presented his kingly claims before them? So there was the wise men in Jerusalem, and then the other people who were brought in to join the debate, and it boils up, and in the middle of it is anxious, paranoid Herod. God coming to earth. It's a stunning thing, actually. What is it like? God coming to earth? Well, as somebody called Simon Jenkins once said, it's like the landlord becoming the lodger. It's like the managing director applying for the post of office boy. It's like Beethoven queuing up for a ticket at one of his own concerts. It's like the headmistress getting detention. It's like Picasso learning to paint by numbers. A tremendous reduction, and yet at the same time still fully God, fully man. It's a mystery. Then the books that have been written this year in Britain alone about Jesus Christ, the films that have been made about him, the television debates, they rage on, the debate goes on and on. Always this consuming interest in Jesus Christ.
So there is a seeker here.
I mean, join the debate. Of course.
We're glad for you to take your part in this Christian family, as we call it. And you may be from some other faith. You may think to yourself, will somebody get at me? Will somebody make life unpleasant for me if I join in things here? No, nobody will get at you. I think you're safe here. Nobody will undermine you as a person or manipulate you in any way. But join the debate. When the new year comes, join our new course of a course that we put on regularly called Christianity Explained. I've got a card here. Look out for that card afterwards and think to yourself, I'll join that course. I'll ask all my questions. Nobody will get at me, but I will have plenty to ask and to explore. I wish to debate and find out as much as I can. Christianity faces us, as it did really with Herod in those far-off days, with a debate. If you're not in the debate, I mean, we should be in it. This is the most important event that has ever taken place, if it's true. If it's not true, let's explode it. Let's forget about it. Let's put up our shutters and go home and have coffee and try and make the best of this world and try and believe that we are just collections of biochemical reactions floating in a strange, impersonal, mechanistic universe. But if Christmas is true, it's very important. There's a debate on. We need to be part of it. Christmas faces us with a debate. Secondly, Christmas faces us with displacement. That's the second thing I think that we learn from this little passage as we look at Herod. He was deeply troubled. But why? Because he felt this displacement aspect of the message of the new king. It lay partly in his own character. Herod was a Jew of Edomite extraction. He had very few friends anywhere. He'd been given his title, King of the Jews, by the Roman Senate. And in all, he was to govern Judea on behalf of the Romans for 36 years, Herod the Great. With his many enemies, he had become paranoid about his own security. And the ruins of his many buildings illustrate that. And so did his behavior, I'm afraid, to his own family, whom several of them he eliminated. As Augustus Caesar once commented, it is safer to be Herod's pig than his son. And Herod was powerful, and he was very superstitious. To him it was very significant that the men from the east should have asked on arrival for news of he who has been born King of the Jews. And to Herod that title was a hard-won honor. Under Antony and Octavian, he'd been given the title, but it only became effective after 3 years' intensive fighting. Here then, in this visit from the eastern strangers, was a threat, however small it may have seemed to be. He was deeply troubled, because he sensed displacement coming. Another king, yes, and an alternative kingdom. Ladies and gentlemen, if you and I sometimes feel very discouraged as we look around our world and see what's happening, on continent after continent, when we can hardly think of any country anywhere that's got a strong degree of stability about it, if you sometimes feel discouraged, read back a little into the sweep of history and see how the brittleness of successive kingdoms and empires, some good and some bad, contrast with the continuity of God's kingdom, with its four great characteristics of peace, justice, permanence, and universality. When we had read earlier in our first reading from Daniel chapter 7, and we read earlier in the chapter about those four great beasts, terrible beasts, threatening beasts, that Daniel the prophet sees in his vision, as we are told in the interpretation, they stand for four great kingdoms. At the time, it was to do with Babylon. That was the time that he is writing about. But they stood, in fact, for Babylon, then Medo-Persia, that succeeded Babylon, then the Greek kingdom with its Seleucid leaders, and then, of course, Rome, finally, which tired about them all, I suppose. How quick they were to fall. Babylon fell in a single night. You've only to read Daniel chapter 5, and if you know the story of the great feast, and then of the writing on the wall, the man's hand, Mine, mine, tikel euphasin. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Your kingdom is going to be removed tonight. And it was. In 1 hour, Babylon fell. And in came the Medes and Persians with their kingdom. Then they fell, and in came the Greeks. And the Greeks had, maybe they were most notorious for one of their leaders called Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes made life hell for the Jewish people. It was perhaps the worst time that the Jewish people have ever been through under Antiochus Epiphanes. He's never mentioned by name in the Bible. But when we read phrases in the New Testament like the abomination of desolation, standing where he ought not, the sage Bible scholars nod wisely and they say, of course, yes, that's right. That's a reference back to Antiochus Epiphanes. Terrible man, terrible monster, terrible tyrant. But he was vulnerable. In 169 BC, as Rome was beginning to take center stage and as Greece was beginning to lose its power, there was Antiochus Epiphanes struggling on, and he made a bid for Egypt, tried to grab Egypt and marched upon Egypt with his army. And the Romans knew about it, and they sent one senator, that's all they sent, a senator called Papilius, to stop Antiochus. He met with him in the open air, and he said to him, the Roman Senate desires that you withdraw your troops and go home immediately. Antiochus said, I'll think about it. No, said Papilius. He took a stick, and in the dust he drew a circle around the feet of Antiochus Epiphanes. Answer me, he said, before you get out of that. And Antiochus Epiphanes, the abomination of desolation, bowed to the superior incoming authority of the Roman Empire and took his troops home that very day. The day of the Greeks was over. The day of the Romans was over just 5 centuries later. It all happened in a single day, August the 24th, 410 AD, when Alaric, the leader of the Visigoth hordes, swept upon Rome, and in one day Rome was sacked. It was the end of the Roman Empire. They can be very brittle, these things. We've seen it in our own day. We couldn't have believed what we were seeing to the communist empire in Soviet Russia. But then some of us were there, 45 of the musicians from this church, and Gerard was there, who's been conducting us tonight, and I was there. Great privilege to be there in Moscow. And you will have seen the photograph that I put on the screen at this time last week of the KGB. It was my photograph of the year. I can't forget it. As the Russian guide said to me, that is the KGB. I looked at it, and outside was a cross. I said, what has happened then? Oh, she said, they had you see that great plinth? On it used to be standing the first head of the KGB, Vyshinsky, a dreaded man, head of the dreaded KGB, the secret service place. Then, after the fall of communism in Moscow, the Moscow citizens ripped down the statue. They put in its place an enormous cross instead. And so I think to myself, an extraordinary logo now for the KGB. An extraordinary symbol outside it. There is the cross. As the hymn puts it, in the cross of Christ I glory, towering o'er the wrecks of time. There's another kingdom. Another kingdom that continues amid buffetings, adversity, persecutions, discouragement, but it's still there. And so we saw that symbolized outside the KGB in Moscow 8 weeks ago. Or we think of Acts in chapter 17, verse 7, as the Christian faith was knocking on the doors of Europe for the first time. And as it came in for the very first time, the complaint went up. They are acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. And so the Christmas message does face us across the centuries with displacement. And it also faces us personally with that. It's as we put our trust and give our loyalty to Christ, who is the head of this eternal kingdom, that we find that our own pet possessions our own pet empires that we've allowed to be built around the throne of our personalities has to give way. It has to give way to this incoming authority of a greater kingdom altogether. Christmas is a very personal time. It speaks to us. It speaks to us of a debate. It speaks to us of displacement. And lastly, Christmas faces us with a decision. God came down to earth. That's the title of our sermon. Well, the second century pagan philosopher Celsus asked, in mockery, why should your God come and live on earth? Didn't he know what was going on there? Celsus never did get it. Not at all. He wasn't within a million miles of it, with all his mockery. The message of Christmas is very simple, in essence. It's a rescue story of God intervening in our affairs, in a person, in a human, living among us, being born among us, seeing us, helping us, dying for us, and taking into himself the sins and the responsibility of our sins for the whole world, so that those of us who will put our trust in him, we will have a place in his kingdom. Not waiting until we die to find out how we stand with him, but knowing now that I am accepted in his sight, not because of anything that I've done, but simply because he has done it all, accepting in himself upon the cross the responsibility of the deeds and attitudes that would otherwise shut me out of heaven, so that I can know now that I'm a member, a citizen of the eternal kingdom, and take my place in this world and not feel that I'm a stranger. So that as I look at the strange things that are happening in our world and the terrible events, I can say to myself, I sorrow about it and I grieve, but I understand it. That there is a clash and a collision of kingdoms going on. And I am part of the kingdom that will never be rubbed out, and I will do my bit to represent that kingdom with love and humility and gratitude. It's so simple in the end, a child can get it. That's why they have their little nativity plays in the schools. They can get it. There is one whose name is Jesus, who has been born among us. We may put our trust in him. We may stand with our 2 feet upon this world, knowing that we belong to him forever and that we are called to serve him and to serve others in this context of a different kingdom. Brought home vividly to me, again, 2 months ago, we had a wonderful interpreter, a Russian interpreter for us when we were in Moscow. His name was Oleg. Wonderful vocabulary. He was an intellectual. And shortly before we did our first concert with him, he said, I'd like to pray with you, Richards. I said, let's pray. Then I said to him after our prayer, and how did you come to start? I suppose you were brought up in a Christian family here in Moscow. No, he said, no. It all happened 5 years ago. He said, I was an ardent, committed member of the Communist Youth League. I was a committed atheist. He said, it all happened when I was a teacher at a school. The headmaster sent for me one day and said, there's trouble in the school. The 7-year-old is causing trouble. She's one of these Christian girls. And worse than that, she's a Baptist. Not good. I want you to go and sort it out and stamp out that problem. She's going around saying she's a Christian. Can't have that. So Oleg went to this little 7-year-old girl, and her first question to him was, how sure are you that there is no God? And as he put it to me, he said, I had to admit, I wasn't totally sure. And he said, from that moment on, she opened up my atheistic defenses, and then he said, she led me to a faith in Jesus Christ. He said it was the most humiliating moment of my entire life. There he was, now with his extensive Bible knowledge, as a member of another kingdom. Another kingdom had challenged his. It was as though that little girl had drawn a circle around his feet and said, answer me before you get out of that. And then and there, he became a follower, a member of the different kingdom. giving way to the superior claims of an incoming, permanent kingdom. Herod was faced with a decision when the news reached him of this other king who had been born, and he reacted with frenzied determination to protect himself, even to the extent of killing those little babies in Bethlehem. He might not have reacted so had he known that only within a matter of months he would be dead himself. It doesn't matter whether you're called Antiochus Epiphanes or Alexander the Great, Herod the Great, Napoleon the Great. Eventually, whatever kingdom or private little empire we choose to try and build around ourselves, we are going to have to part with it. In the end, what makes or breaks us as people is whether we have bowed to the superior authority of the kingdom that outlasts all other kingdoms, the members of whom are described in Daniel 7, verse 18, as follows: "For the saints of the Most High have received the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever." The secret lies in our placing our confidence and loyalty and love in this alternative king. What is his name? Jesus the Great? It would be utterly incongruous for us to call him that. No, it's Jesus the Only. Somebody here may be facing a very difficult Christmas, or you may have had an exceedingly difficult year. And yet, your Christmas can be real, truly real, if this Christ is taking central place upon the throne of our personalities, and we allow ourselves to be transferred into a new kingdom, a different kingdom, the lasting kingdom. So Christmas faces us with a debate, with displacement of our own self-centered worldview and pathetic plans, and with a decision. It draws a circle round us. That's what Christmas does, and says, "Answer me before you get out of that." So as we close our service, allow that circle to be drawn around you. It's a beneficent circle, not one of threat. And for some of us, we will underline decisions for Christ that we made years ago. We will say to him again, "I mean it. I meant it. I'm still on for your kingdom." And others will say, "I don't understand it as well as I ought to, but I am on too. I'm going to start." As the challenge comes to us, answer me. Answer me.